of Egypt. He set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. He also made temples in high places and appointed priests from among all the peoples who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. And he went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel. And he went up to the altar to make offerings. And behold, a man of God came out of Judah, and the word of the Lord to Bethel. Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make offerings, and the man cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, "O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you, and the human bone shall be burnt on you." And he gave a sign the same day, saying, "This is the sign that the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be torn down, and the ashes on it shall be poured out." And when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried out against the altar at Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, "Seize him!" And his hand, which he stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. The altar also was torn down, and the ashes poured out from the altar according to the sign that the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. And the king said to the man of God, "Entreat now the favor of the Lord your God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored to me." And the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him. It became as it was before. And the king said to the man of God, "Come home with me and refresh yourself, and I will give you a reward." And the man of God said to the king, "If you give me half your kingdom, I will not go in with you, and I will not eat bread or drink water in this place. For so it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, 'You shall neither eat bread nor drink water, nor return by the way that you came.'" So he went another way and did not return to the way that he came to Bethel. You know, it is indeed hard. We have sometimes lofty goals and valid concerns. And when we seek to motivate others in a certain way, still there's those selfish motivations, the manipulations that we do. And we do sometimes manipulate improperly. And in so doing can very easily involve our manipulations that would be then immoral. But in the end of the day, as we see here in this passage, that just like Jeroboam, it comes to the point where we recognize we are impotent to manipulate God. Well, let's take a look in these first two verses how we, just like Jeroboam, can improperly manipulate. Now, Jeroboam begins with a sense of self-preservation. That's part of his improper hidden heart and motivation. He goes out and he builds a fortress in Shechem. Now he no longer has Jerusalem and the great fortress that's there. And so in the northern country, he builds Shechem. And Shechem he chooses for a good three reasons. One, it is a defensive, strong position of any invading armies coming from the south to the north, from Jerusalem, from the tribe of Judah. It's defensive. It's also well situated on the east-west highway for trading from the far further east to from Egypt. But there's another reason. Shechem was the first stopping point for Abraham as he entered the promised land. It was by the oaks, Shechem there, that Abraham stopped, and it was always considered a very sacred place. So there is some propaganda that's happening here as Jeroboam is trying to motivate, manipulate his people to see this is indeed a valid kingdom. Jeroboam doesn't stop there. He fortifies Peniel, and Jeroboam realizes he needs more security than God's promises. He doesn't trust God's promises that he had given back in chapter 11. He's willing to do it himself. And because the main thing he's recognizing is true for all of us, that the one who betrays so quickly can feel so easily betrayed. And in light of all of that, that concern, that fear, that worry is indeed taking place. But it goes further. Look in verse 26. We see the veil on Jeroboam's heart being pulled back. It's not only for self-preservation, but he's going to self-preservation by controlling others. And this heart that's a manipulator is beginning to shine and show through. We often don't see this in ourselves. Instead, we can justify and excuse even the most ill-conceived plans under the pious grid of what is good for others. But look what's in Jeroboam's heart when it says, the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. You see, he's scared. He's scared not of God, but of the people. The ones he rules, they are ruling him. That sense of what's going on in his heart, the idolatry that is there, is not a fear of God doing what God has commanded, but it's a fear of what others might do or what they might not do, how they might turn away from him. He fears losing the people's adoration. He worries that he'll be rejected. And the outcome for him is certainly great because he knows it's not just he'll lose a friend, but even more, he could lose his very life. But the way he describes it, his concern is not for the benefit of others, but is really for himself. He fortifies cities, but he wants to fortify his position as well. And so what's it going to do to keep the 10 tribes from going back to Jerusalem to worship there? Well, political devotion demands religious dedication, and as often the case, the two are wedded together. And he says, you know, if they go to Jerusalem, they'll return, notice to that statement in verse 27, they'll return to their Lord Rehoboam. He even says words that they haven't said. They have given their allegiance to Jeroboam, to the northern tribes. Rehoboam in the south is king over Judah. But in his heart of hearts, Jeroboam knows he doesn't have enough control that their hearts could so easily turn back to Rehoboam if they go down to Jerusalem. What's driving him is the loss of control, of adoration, the loss of his life, and his heart reveals to himself, to all of us, who the true king is supposed to be. He knows what he has to do to keep them loving him, to give them, he has to give them what they want. He will manipulate them out of his own idolatrous heart and create more idols. Really, for us, a sense of manipulation comes through when we think, how do we try to exercise control? What motivations kick in and why? Now, again, just because we motivate or even manipulate someone is not necessarily in and of itself as evil. There can be good things we should do to motivate our kids, to encourage those around us. Not saying that, but the conflict that can often take place. You have to ask yourself, why is X so important to me that I have to engage in this type of motivation, this manipulation? It's important that your kid not slug his friend over the Fisher-Price pirate ship. Yeah, we know that. But is it because it's an offense against God's moral law that the little one has just broken the sixth commandment by using that aggressive, murderous force, the eighth command by stealing and taking the ship? Is it because he is coveting and is recognizing indeed that in his own heart is worshiping something other than God? Is that going through your mind? No, probably not. What usually is going through a parent's mind is that you just don't want to hear the whining and fussing over the toy. It's fear that what the other parents might think, what your in-laws might say about your parenting skills, as they perhaps blame the genetics of the child on your side of the family for creating such a monster. And so we manipulate sometimes with those mixed motives involved. The first step is to know your own heart. And in so saying, why am I doing what I want to do? Why are these things so very important to me? Otherwise, we might have idols that we ignore and treat as though they're really unimportant. No, we can improperly motivate, and in so doing, begin to immorally motivate. And that's what Jeroboam does next in verses 28 through the end of the chapter. This immoral manipulation appeals to his selfish interest. This unchecked heart leads him down a road. I mean, asking, you know, acknowledging that what's going on in his heart doesn't mean he's necessarily going to do something, therefore that's wrong, but that's where it so quickly goes. And so he begins to devise a plan. he's playing off their selfish interest. If self-interest is what drives us, we're going to motivate others by it. Think how you motivate people and encourage them, how you manipulate them. If self-interest is what it's all about, that's the tendency you'll use to get the behavior you want to see as well. And in so doing, it can totally miss the gospel itself. And that's what Jeroboam does. He says, you've gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Really implying, you know, what we've got here in the north is just as good as anything they've got in the south. And if it's just as good, then let me show you what it is that we have that is so good. And so what he does is unthinkable. You know, earlier in 1 Kings 12, Jeroboam comes across as the Moses who is freeing the enslaved Israelites from their Judean king, who's almost like Pharaoh Rehoboam. He's leading this sense of freedom. But soon this Moses is really nothing more than an old Aaron. Recall in Exodus how Aaron, when Moses was receiving the Ten Commandments, Aaron led the people and molded the golden calf and said, this is the God who brought you out of Egypt. Jeroboam does the exact same thing. He plays right out of the same playbook. But he really is doing something a lot more. This is a political tool to manipulate. You know, some of the commentators say, you know, he's really not introducing idolatry here. And you kind of go, what? It's a golden calf. That sounds real normal. They go, well, you need to understand in the ancient Near East, it was quite common to fashion a bull or a calf that would be the pedestal upon which the idol was placed. In some ways, not much different than the Ark of the Covenant, that it was a pedestal for the invisible God. And so Jeroboam is saying, you know, they've got the Ark, we don't have that, so, you know, we'll create something that will point them to the invisible God. Almost sounds innocent. It is so manipulative and devious. And that's the heart that's beginning to come through that seeks to bring this man-made system about. They're really, in so doing, he's saying Jerusalem now is no longer your place of worship. And what he puts in its place is not that sense of atonement that is made by a God who has called people to be his own. Instead, what he is doing is saying there's a man-made system in which we can please God. And he sets one of them up in Bethel. Again, another great move. Bethel, about 19 miles north of Jerusalem, so that if the people were saying, I really miss the temple and the beauty and the majesty and the worship there that pointed me to the God who has made the covenant promise to us. And as they're going down, what town do they have to pass through? They have to go through Bethel. Oh, but wait, you know, it's a whole day or a two-day journey I could save. I could just stop right here and save time and money. Bethel's just as convenient. And it's not that different of a worship. It has the same basic ideas, doesn't it? And so they stop in Bethel. Bethel has some other aspects. Again, using this sense of connection to the past. Remember, Bethel was where Jacob, as he's fleeing his brother Esau after lying to their father Isaac, he spends the night in Bethel. The word Bethel means house of God. And there has the dream of the ladder with the angels ascending and descending. Bethel was an important religious place. And so he associates their worship with, again, just like with Abraham and Shechem, here Bethel and Jacob saying, we have an ancient faith. This is something worth holding on to. And it motivates them, manipulates them by that. The other calf is put up in Dan, up in the far north. Again, as the text tells us, people would travel all the way to Dan because that was such a great place to worship the other calf. Dan has an association in Judges 18, generations, centuries before, how the Israelites worshipped idols there, and so it seemed quite natural to do that. But through it all, he was appealing to their selfish interest. In a sense, appealing to a degree of national pride. You know, it's kind of like slap a flag on it, call it American, and you can't speak against it. You're going to manipulate the people to ignoring some of the other issues going on. And that's what's happening here. But not only that, it's not only the self-interest, this sense of nationalism he's imposing, he's also showing a certain degree of freedom, of equality that everybody loves, a certain democratization in the whole process. He doesn't stop there in manipulating the people. He gives them a sense of ease, of accessibility, and equality that empowered people. You know, at the end verses 31, 32, 33 in chapter 12, in Hebrew, there's a repeated word. It comes again and again. It's the word made. You'll see it there a lot in English. Sometimes it's not even translated. They use a different word. But there's a repetition that's used. He made these temples, these houses of worship. He made these altars. He made people to be priests. Because it's identifying this was out of his own sinful heart, trying to manipulate people to do what he wanted them to do. And the one thing that stands out there with this manipulation, this crafting by his hands, the high places throughout the region, we're saying this, you know, those silly Judeans, they only have one temple, one place of worship. And if you want to worship there, you got to travel so far. We have options here. We have choice, and choice is good, is it not? You like choice. Everybody likes choice. But not only that, they have a caste system. They have this hierarchy. It's old and heavy. It's authoritarian. What is that? That to be a priest, you have to be born among the Levites. But you know, what if I feel called to be a priest, or that person feels called a priest, but they're not among the Levitical tribe? You know, here in Israel, we have a much better system. What we will do is anyone who wants to be a priest, you can be a priest. Who cares the structure, the system that God set down? Here, we are talking about complete equality, an egalitarian spirit. So God's prescribed order, let's face it, feels so restrictive, seems so unfair. And he's going to win their heart and motivate them to do what they want, all the while ignoring God's law. And we see the same in our own world, from the courts to the public court of Facebook, as seeking to redefine marriage. No, it's a manipulating of a wax nose. To many, it sounds just and equitable and fair, but it weakens the fabric of society. It's contrary to God's design. And through it all, by making and saying there is this sense of equality, why do we do that? Because by doing it, we can excuse our own failures. We can say, you know, my sins aren't all that bad. Or because my sins are that bad, I want everyone to join in just like me. There was a book written years ago, and I was going to mention, I thought, oh, it's so old and dated, until I read an article just Friday, in which they quoted the same book. It's a book by a guy named Bella called Habits of the Heart. A very interesting study back in the 80s of American religion. And there's one famous interview with a woman named Sheila saying, "What is your religious orientation?" And she comes right out and says, "I believe in Sheilaism. I am my own God." And in many ways, it describes American religious attitudes, even within the context of the church. I believe in Sheilaism. And that's what he was promoting here. So Jeroboam blurs the distinctions, not because they're unnerving, but he wants nothing to do with what God had revealed. Not because he's saying it's false. It's just too inconvenient. His own heart wants something else. He does not want David's royal son. He does not want the atoning sacrifice. And so it says there in verse 33, he devises these things from his own heart. How often do you get people to follow? The question really is, how do you get people to follow such pragmatic paganism? You know, especially if you've been steeped in the Word. It's very simple. You change just the slightest thing that captures their attention. You want to cover up the stench of apostasy? Just call it something else. Jeroboam offers choice, diversity, freedom from authority. To manipulate the people to remain devoted to him, all he has to do is construct a system contrary to God, but give it some of the same look and feel, and no one will notice. Case in point, 1930s, there was a certain horse liniment that had been quite popular. Sales were declining. It was through the 20s and 30s, with the advent of the automobile, the question was, not many people had horses, so who's going to buy horse liniment? Well, the job was turned over to an ad exec named O.B. Winters, who tested the liniment that was used to relax horses' tired muscles, and found that it had another good cure. It really worked well on ringworm. The trouble is, who here wants to admit they have ringworm? So Obi Winters had a stroke of genius. He conjured up a new name for ringworm. Do you know what it is? It's called athlete's foot. You know what? I've had athlete's foot. Because I have feet. And I'm an athlete, you know. To say, I have ringworm. No, it's gross. Don't tell me this. I have athlete's foot. Well, you know what? It's the same thing. And so this horse liniment, known as Absorbine, just stuck the word junior on it. And Absorbine Junior is still selling today to cure athlete's foot, also ringworm. It's all about perception. Now, we do that in advertising. We understand. We engage in the manipulative world of marketing. But when we do it with our faith, when we do it with each other and trying to get them to do what we want them to do, we have a problem. The actions sometimes is redirect attention away from our sin to either a good that we do or the bad things that others do. The flip side of all of this is that we can so easily accept things that we should not. You know, we know how to manipulate. In our relationships, they're the games that we play to get our spouse to do what we want him or her to do. It may be as subtle as pout or the aggressive voice. We can manipulate others to think well, even while we're struggling and we don't want to let them in. But in the end of the day, to first recognize we have those idols that propel us to manipulate is so critical. But then take a step back and recognize we are impotent in one area. And that's that story in chapter 13. We are impotent to manipulate God. One, because God is judge. God will not allow this to continue. He sends a prophet from the south, from Judah. And while Jeroboam is acting the role of the priest, having a bull session at the altar there at Bethel, the prophet shows up and he ruins the day. Notice what he does. He predicts that a Josiah will be born to the line of David. Now, if you know the story, and the first readers, they knew the ending of the story. They read this well after it was all over. This is 300 years later. He's saying, Jeroboam, Josiah is going to come, and he's going to destroy all of this. Yeah, 300 years from now. Well, in the meantime, let me show you something else. Let me tell you something else. And so he explains this altar right then and there is going to be destroyed. Jeroboam sought to control the people by manipulating their worship to their own liking. But God was not going to be shaped and twisted in that way. What Jeroboam feared, he was powerless really to control. He manipulated the people, but he couldn't manipulate God. And so Jeroboam learns firsthand that his megalomania is going to be his own downfall. He orders his devoted followers to seize the prophet, and his arm is outstretched. It becomes palsied, withered, useless. And that moment, the altar breaks, sending the ashes to the ground, spoiling and ruining, desecrating the sacrifice. Now, let's face it. So rare is it that God's judgment seems so very clear. But our intimacy or our impotency to manipulate those around us, and especially to manipulate God, should be clear without a prophetic voice saying it. See, the great lie of our age is that we really are in control. We idolize the manipulation of our world. Our God is a God of technology. With a keystroke, we can find anything. With a pill, we can cure anything. And then we are forced to come to the point in our life and we recognize we can't do that with God. But God is not going to be silenced. But even in his judgment, he's still gracious. Because notice what happens next. As he stretches out his arm and he loses it, he turns, it seems, from his manipulation. It's like he's out of tricks. Nothing else he can do. Notice what he says to this man of God, this prophet from the south, from Judea. Entreat the Lord, your God. Strange. It's going to look like he is turning away. He's repenting of his manipulation. But is he really? Now, God is gracious to let us know of our own impotency. God graciously allows us to see that we are not nearly as competent as we want others to think. But are we really changing our hearts? What he does next shows that he's still a manipulator at the heart. God heals him. And so he says to this man of God, come home with me. Let me give you a reward. Doesn't that sound so appreciative? A simple thank you. And this man of God, he comes across such a jerk. I won't even drink your water in this place. I won't eat a piece of your bread. You could give me half of your palace. I don't want it. Why? Because he recognizes that heart of a manipulator is still there. He, Jeroboam, so much wants indeed to be accepted and loved, and he wants to manipulate. Stay in Bethel. Just stay here. You know, I sought to bribe the tribes to worship at Bethel. I'm going to try to bribe you to remain. But he would not take it. So it brings us to that question. What is the answer to manipulators like us? Because we do this. Oh, no, we don't erect, you know, altars and create sacrifice. We wouldn't think of that kind of idolatry, but we manipulate others to do what we want out of our own desires. What's God's answer to us? How easy is it for us to play the game with others and God? And the prophet would not take Jeroboam's reward. He would not even eat the morsel of bread. There's nothing really that this wayward king could do. There's nothing that you and I can do but to receive his grace. We have before us this table, this meal. It is not our gift to God, saying, God, you've been so good, here's our thank you, as though in some sort of pagan ritual we can manipulate God or the gods to do as we please and as we like. Not that at all. What it does do for us is remind us that God invites us to his table, that he is giving something to us. And in doing that, we are called to receive it. And by receiving it, we're acknowledging indeed the manipulative hearts that we all do have. We do it with everyone in our life, be they our children, our parents. We do it with each other as we try to put on the veneer that we have our act together. And God says, give it up. Acknowledge that idolatry, that need to be loved and accepted, the need to be in control, and realize that I'm a God who is here for you. And I will feed you, and I will nourish you. That's really what the meal is all about. It's indeed why when Paul wrote to those in the city of Corinth, those opening words that we so often hear and read and repeat and consider, that this table is a means of God's grace. It's his physically feeding us so that we would clearly understand the spiritual significance of the gospel of grace. And so, as the word tells us and reminds us, when Paul says, for I received from the Lord what I delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took the bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way also, he took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever, therefore, eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of profaning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself, then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. But if we judged ourselves truly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are disciplined, so that we may not be condemned along with the world. And as we celebrate this meal, and as we do this every first Sunday of the Lord's Day, we do so as that great reminder. And even as the kids are coming back in and watching the participation here, it is that important thing. You talk to your kids as they come to that point, owning the covenant for themselves, saying, I want to receive the Lord's Supper, because in so doing, I want to identify myself as belonging to Christ. And as we do this, as we pass the elements, encourage them to see and have that sensation of what God has promised in his word, that he will feed us and nourish us as we are his. The elders would come forward at this